have a fixed text, but actually I'm going to talk to you today, and I'm going to try to just suggest to you some of the spectrum of things that women wrote in relation to slavery, their contribution to anti-slavery, largely in Britain. But I'm going to be a little bit perverse, and I'm going to start with a poet, a black poet, Phyllis Wheatley, whose book of poetry was first published, although she lived in America, and she was a slave who belonged to the family of a well-off tailor and his wife. Her book was published first in Britain in 1773 and was well known in Britain when the anti-slavery movement really gets going in the 1780s. And she seems to me a very important figure, and I'm going to begin with her, and I'm going to end with a poet who's written, I think, the most interesting and in some ways the most frightening anti-slavery poem long after Britain had abolished slavery in the 1840s, directed at America, Elizabeth Barrett Browning. And Elizabeth's parents were, of course, slave owners, and Elizabeth herself, although she was fiercely anti-slavery, she actually believed in compensation being paid to slave owners. So we move from the poetry of a slave who was eventually manumitted to another powerful poem by a slave owner. And in between, I'm going to talk a little bit about Hannah Moore, who's a figure, a very important figure in the anti-slavery movement in Britain, but a very conservative figure politically, and whose major poem, Slavery, a Poem, which is, she renames the Black Slave Trade, a poem written at the behest of William Wilberforce, who's a figure, is that a name that resonates for all of you? Yes, especially since 2007 and all the celebrations about the slave trade. And she's a member of one of the prominent members of the Clapham sect, the evangelicals who were campaigned against the slave trade and later against slavery. But she is also known and first known to me when I was working on another kind of radical figure from the late 18th century, Tom Paine, when I was a young woman. He was my hero. And, of course, Hannah Moore loathed people like Tom Paine, revolutionary figures, and she devoted some of her tracts to trying to persuade the working classes that they mustn't read people like Paine and that they were mad. So she's a very interesting figure, and as Marcus Wood in this big volume, which I highly recommend to you, Oxford University Press, called The Poetry of Slavery, an Anglo-American Anthology, 1764-1865, which has it's only a selection. It's a kind of highlights of the poetry against slavery, which shows what a large oeuvre that is. But he's got excellent introductions to a good introduction to the whole history, situating the poetry. And he's got excellent little bios and commentaries on each writer in the book. And one of the things he says is quite true about Hannah Moore is that she's very hard for feminists, for example, to map into a history of prominent women, because she didn't really believe in women's emancipation. She's no Mary Wollstonecraft, who's also anti-slavery, and she had her causes. Just because of that, I think more recently, she's received quite a lot of attention. People are much more interested in looking at figures who seem, you know, who seem to a modern eye much more contradictory. And one thing that I would want to say about anti-slavery is it cut across political lines very powerfully. Whig, Tory, so forth, it didn't really matter. It drew in people from all kinds of Protestant religions and sect. The Quakers were, of course, very important. The Baptists, because of their missionary work, were hugely important, but also evangelical Christians were, you know, powerful leaders. I've started with an image probably well known to you, the famous Wedgwood, Josiah Wedgwood image himself, of course, an important anti-slavery figure. And it's the kneeling slave on the medal, "Am I not a man and a brother?" Now, it's one of those questions that's supposed to be taken for a statement. yes, you're supposed to say, "I am a man and a brother."
But the very fact that the man is petitioning, kneeling, chained, is supposed to evoke, of course, your pity and your belief in the emancipation. But the kneeling man himself is in a position of subservience. And so who he's asking the question to is clearly the white holder or purchaser of this anti-slavery token and the medal. It sets up all kinds of reverberations around the relationship of people who were strongly anti-slavery but who were not necessarily a believer in the absolute equality, intellectual, political, and social of persons of other races than the white race. So they're very, you know, it's both a very powerful symbol, one of the most powerful images we have from the 18th century and early 19th century movement, and it's also one of the most complicated, I think. It's very interesting to think about. Now, this is the image that my friend Keith, who puts together my PowerPoint presentations because I'm an idiot, found on the web. I said, grab all these images from the web. And you can see it's an American one adopted. And, of course, it's the woman counterpart to this. Am I not a woman and a sister? And, again, we take those terms. Again, it's a kneeling woman in the same position as the man on the, you know. It's got liberty written right across here on the back of the coin. The very fact that it is a coin, when so much of the discussion of slavery in the late 18th century, you know, is about the money grubbing slave traders, you know, that people are doing, you know, in the business of selling humans, selling souls, and so forth. The coin itself is a kind of paradoxical representation of, you know, a kind of anti-coin, if you like, a coin that passes between people who are against slavery. But again, the woman and the sister, you're supposed to say, yes, that's right, I'm one of those. But again, she's a supplicant. So one of the things I think that's interesting about the way in which the poetics of slavery and the politics of slavery, poetics and politics of anti-slavery come together, is to question what the anti-slavery movement did to interrogate hierarchical relations of all kinds in the family, class relations in Britain. There were working class poets. They were just amongst the women who wrote poetry, but amongst anti-slavery women altogether, there were aristocrats. There were Anne Yearsley, working class poets. Chartists wrote anti-slavery poet. As I say, ran across denominational groups, politics, and so forth. But within those anti-slavery circles, what sorts of hierarchy were they thinking still had to stay in place? And how did they imagine what the world after abolition would be like? That was also a very interesting question. And nobody knew this better or more than, I think, some of the Baptist missionaries who were part of the exhibit today. Because, first of all, the Baptists were often, you know, thought of as accused of fomenting rebellion among slaves in the period leading up to abolition, and in after abolition, the whole question of what the new free population would be like, that was also a big issue for the Baptists, and a very troubling one. Nobody writes about that better than historian Catherine Hall, and I would recommend to you her book Civilizing Subjects, which has a whole section on people like Nib and so forth, and the experience between Jamaica and the metropole and England. And a wonderful read and very, very interesting. But one thing that when I was talking to Catherine about this talk, she said, do emphasize, she said, how male-dominated the anti-slavery movement was and how crucial, you know, when you're talking about women, how absolutely important it was to say, you know, that poetry and writing were one of the outlets women could have in supporting the anti-slavery movement. We could divide that movement a little bit, so I'm saying it. It's true, it was. And, you know, the wives are kind of, somebody I've been reading, you know, sort of shadows of the men when you read the kind of missionary archives that we have here. But of course, there are standout women in the, you know, in the anti-slavery pantheon that we can all name. But in the movement itself, women formed in the later period. And I'm going to talk about in a second the different periodizations we might have. When they formed their own anti-slavery groups, the whole question of whether they would actually be able to write petitions to Parliament, for example, was one that was heavily debated, with some of the anti-slavery leaders saying, no, they should only petition the Queen, you know, and whether they should be allowed to sign petitions at all, whether they should be able to stand up and give speeches. In the United States, there were a lot of women eloquent women, anti-slavery speakers. That was very uncommon in Britain, very uncommon indeed. And indeed, at the World Anti-Slavery Conference, others of you might know this story, but a lot of men and women and anti-slavery men and women came from the United States to Britain, and the British conventions had the women sitting separately, and William Lloyd Garrison, the fiery American abolitionist leader, was so outraged by this that he went and sat with the women. they were sort of behind a screen. They were rather behind the Americans, but the Americans too had people in, you know, Presbyterian and Methodist ministers who didn't like the idea of women starting to speak out on platforms. And of course, they didn't like it for a very good reason, because those same women, many of them, with some who then went on to speak about women's rights in a few years' time. So, to emphasize that, of course, women had they didn't have a vote, but also convention, even in a period where we might say they had more prominence as writers than they did in parts of the 19th century, where they were less restrained about what they could write. Their public presence was something that was heavily policed and contained. So that's quite important to remember, and I'm going to say some more specific things about that. So before I get going on my poets, I just wanted to say a few quick things and about the periodization. So in Britain, the movement to abolish the slave trade, which of course included people who wanted to abolish slavery altogether, but that first step to abolish the slave trade gets going in the mid to the late 1780s, and it goes very powerfully with Wilberforce bringing before Parliament, you know, bills to abolish the trade, which keep getting knocked down from the late 80s to the early 90s. And it hots up again in the early part of the early part of the 19th century, with the abolition actually going through Parliament in 1807. So you have a period of great activity from about 1787-88 through the early 90s. And then what intervenes, of course, is the French Revolution and the wars and a ferocious clampdown on public meetings and a kind of political reaction. And then there's again a kind of rise of sentiment and so forth. The extra-parliamentary movements and what goes on in Parliament, that's quite complicated, and I'm not going to go into that today. But we might want to say that, of course, one of the extra-parliamentary things that is extremely important is what people wrote and said. And what women wanted to do was to change, we might just say crudely, the hearts and minds of people. They wanted to, even if they, you know, to change the whole culture's belief that slavery was an okay and ordinary thing. So you have that period roughly, say, 1780s to 1807, and then again around 1923, the movement picks up again for abolition of slavery, the first gradual, but more and more people within the movement speaking for immediate emancipation. You don't get immediate emancipation, of course, when the bill is passed in 1833. In August 1834, you have a period of apprenticeship for the former slaves, and that isn't done away with till 1838. But that movement from 23 saw an absolute outpouring of pamphlet literature and writing of all kinds, which is still I think, really sort of untouched. And, you know, people have written bits and pieces about it, but it still doesn't have the full attention that I think it probably deserves from historians. As writing itself, you know, as a form of writing, I think it's extremely important. Now, I wanted to just mention some of the people that you might think about as anti-slavery women, ranging from the aristocracy, the Duchess of Devonshire, radical figures, but a group of radical figures who more supported the French Revolution, Helen Maria Williams, Anna Letitia Barbauld, in her youth, Amelia Anderson, who later married the portrait painter John Opie and became Amelia Opie and a little bit more conservative, but always anti-slavery. Mary Wollstonecraft, the working class poet Anne Yearsley, the evangelicals Hannah More, and so forth. And the most interesting figure to me, and to think some of my students when we were teaching the course, Mary Robinson, who was an actress, a poet, the mistress of the Prince of Wales. She was an extraordinary person altogether, and she wrote some excellent poetry, and I wish we had time to look at it today. What kind of poetry are we talking about? In this period, of course, loads of people wrote political satire. Poetry was seen both as the high art of literature, but also absolutely, as a vehicle for political ideas. So while there was lyric poetry, sentimental poetry, all kinds of poetry, there's a very wide range of poetic expression. And people felt it was poetry's become a kind of minority sport, I feel, in modern times. And when students come into university, they say, oh, well, we don't know if we really want to read poetry. That's hard, isn't it? We can read fiction and the novel. But that isn't how 18th century readers, I think, thought about it. And, you know, broadsides of all kinds, you probably know all this. So the poetry that women, that was written about anti-slavery, men and women, of course, wrote it hugely. You know, that was not a huge departure to write about these political subjects. So what I want to do is think a little bit about how they wrote about it, and what kind of issues we might think about it. Of course, the poetry was published often late, sometimes in collections of poetries by single people, but they were also in periodicals of all kinds. They interleaved with other kinds of writing in newspapers, in religious publications, but also in dedicated anti-slavery things like The Liberty Bell, where Elizabeth Barrett Browning published her poem. That was a Boston annual that was sold for the benefit of the anti-slavery movement. And when you look at the poems in situ, where they're published, what's really, really interesting is to look at the things they're next to. This is why I wish I'd got some things to show you. You know, how a poem can appear in a newspaper, and it can appear, an anti-slavery poem can appear, and on the next page there'll be an advertisement for a runaway slave. You know, the poetry can appear again, you know, alongside prose that denounces the sympathies in the poetry or supports them in another way. People had people cited poems all the time. If you read the 19th century novel, do you all read the 19th century novel? You know, how much poetry is interleaved in those novels? You know, we think of it somehow, I think, ones where we're much too genre-bound these days, and the 18th century was less so. So the audiences are wide. I mean, the audiences for a lot of the poetry that I'm talking about are middle-class audiences, for sure, but some of that poetry was also read by groups who were not so middle-class. And even if we think about class, we can think about the Baptists, who were seen as a not very upper-class group, as opposed to the evangelicals and so forth. Those fine gradations that the British are so fond of. And that was true in the States, too, you know, that they were... Congregationalists and Unitarians were more genteel and better off than the Baptists and the Methodists and so forth. So, you know, those spectrums are important. Okay, what I want to do now is turn... Okay, I want to talk about Phyllis Wheatley a little bit. And I've put her on your handout. And I put two poems by her. She was born in 1753 and she died quite young in 1784. Miserable, free, emancipated, but very poor and semi-forgotten. But she was writing poetry right up to the end of her life. And she came... but she was probably seized in Senegal, Gambia, West Africa, when she was about 7 years old, and transported to the Boston docks in a slave ship called Phyllis. That was her first name, ironically. And she was sold happily for her to the Wheatley family. A tailor and his wife were quite enlightened figures, and they saw very quickly that she was an incredibly smart child, and they taught her. Allowed her to be taught to read and write. She was still sort of a semi-servant, but she quickly mastered Greek and Latin. She was, you know, she was a little child prodigy, and she began to write at a very early age. She also had a lot of... She wasn't an isolated person. She had friends within the black communities. She was lucky to live... she was lucky to live in Boston, so she, you know, there were many people... that she was friends with, but she was sort of nurtured by the Wheatley family and encouraged to go on writing, and she wrote a series of very interesting poems. She probably wrote about 145 poems in all. We only have the collection that was in her 1773 book there. The rest, a few other poems got published in periodicals and are, you know, have been rediscovered. But she had another whole book of poems that she was trying to get published at the time of her death, and she couldn't get subscriptions for it. So that's quite interesting. One of the interesting things about Phyllis Wheatley is that she had to prove that she was the author of these poems. So disbelieving were even the liberal anti-slavery sort of business that a young black woman could be the author of serious verse. That she was examined over and over again by, you know, by leading American figures, and when they were satisfied that she actually wasn't a fraud, then she became a more respectable figure. But she still couldn't get the poems published in the United States, and that's why she came to England in the 1770s. Okay, I want to just look at the poems that you've got in front of you. The first poem she wrote was probably this one to the University of Cambridge in New England. And I thought since we were in Oxford, you'd find it interesting to see the first thing she decided to do. You know, Boston and Cambridge are on other sides of the Charles River, and so, you know, was to talk to the young students about how they should behave. She's about, 1920 when she's writing these poems, so she's a very young woman herself. And she talks about it with great authority. One of the things I think is interesting is how untentative these are as poems. They're not, you know, straight up anti-slavery poems, but they are, by the very fact of their writing, an argument against against the use, you know, the against slavery itself. While an intrinsic ardor prompts to write, the muses promise to assist my pen. 'Twas not long since I left my native shore, the land of errors and Egyptian gloom. Father of mercy, 'twas thy gracious hand brought me in safety from those dark abodes. And you can see that's the same theme that she develops. That she develops in this later poem, probably her most famous poem, on being brought from Africa to America. 'Twas mercy brought me from my pagan land, taught my benighted soul to understand that there's a God and there's a Savior too.
one side redemption, neither sought nor knew. So this idea that it was a blessing to be brought even as a slave because of a conversion experience to Christianity is a theme in these poems and in poems also by white anti-slavery women. It's a very prominent theme, and it's one that Phyllis uses. But then, you know, when she's prefaced it by saying, look, you know, here I am, a converted Ethiop, but here I am, I'm here to tell you that you're very lucky people, students to you, to given to scan the heights above, to traverse the ethereal space and mark the systems of revolving worlds. Still more, ye sons of science, ye receive the blissful news by messengers from heaven, how Jesus' blood for your redemption flows. And, you know, it's a religious message. It's a little sermon she's giving him. But here, you know, the cheeky idea that here, you know, here this young black slave is telling the young Harvard undergraduates how to behave and that they should be better Christians, is in itself an extraordinary moment, it seems to me, in poetic experience. And he says, improve and... What matchless mercy in the Son of God, when the whole human race by sin had fallen, he deigned to die that they might rise again and share with him in the sublimest skies, life without death and glory without end. So then she says, improve your privileges while they stay, ye pupils, and each hour redeem that bears or good or bad report of you to heaven. And Ethiop tells you, you know, when she says, suppress the deadly serpent in its egg, ye blooming plants of human race divine, and Ethiop tells you 'tis your greatest foe. And again, the idea that it's the black woman speaking back to the white students is quite extraordinary. And in the other poem on being brought from Africa to America, you see, after the initial introduction of herself, she says, when she's gotten past that notion that, okay, I'm a redeemed figure, she says, some view our sable race with scornful eye, their color is a diabolic dye. Remember, Christians, Negroes, black as Cain, may be refined and join the angelic train. And again, there's an emphasis here on color, but there's also a kind of satirical notion that the scornful eye, their color is a diabolic dye, which she's just dismissing. You know, so it hits on it gently, and then it goes away. Phyllis did have in her poetic eulogy to General David Worcester, a much more straight-out anti-slavery message. But how presumptuous shall we hope to find divine acceptance, I haven't put that there, with almighty mind, while yet, O deed, ungenerous they disgrace, and hold in bondage Africa, blameless race. Let virtue reign, and then accord our prayers, be victory ours and generous freedom theirs. So there is the anti-slavery motif in her poetry. But one of the things I suppose I'm trying to emphasize about Wheatley is that she's not, apart from her Christian belief, she's not an abject kneeling figure of any kind. And that seems to me one of the most important things about this poetry, and one of the most difficult things about when you start to read this larger genre of women and men's anti-slavery writing. What is it that they imagine the Africa is or can be? So I'm just giving you a taste of Hannah Moore, that much more conservative figure, from her very long poem, Slavery, a poem from 1788, right at this crucial moment of bringing into Parliament the bill for the abolition of the slave trade, which it goes down, you know, once, twice, three times. It takes a long time to get it passed. And from the beginning of the poem, I've just given you a couple of lines to give you a sense of that, what she's apostrophizing in that poem. This is number two. If heaven has into being deigned to call thy light, O liberty, to shine on all. And here she's talking, so that the poem begins with a kind of, this poem's going to be about liberty. But then further down on the page, which I haven't given you, she has a long qualification about liberty. Liberty isn't rebellion of the masses. This is pre-French Revolution. You know, we don't want that kind of crude liberty at all.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, she said, in the opening passage, she distinguishes liberty and freedom from popular rebellion and revolution. Mad liberty is imagined as feminine passion running wild, and beauteous order is a kind of masculine figure. And the poem warns against degraded literary sentiment, too. So if you're a reader of that, of Afra Bain's Orinoco, or see the play adapted from his work, where you see this ideal figure of the noble slave, who dies for his freedom. She's saying, well, you know, these are fictions. She says, you should mourn no single wrong, but the countless host dragged from Afric's shores. So she's warning against a liberty that would lead you to sort of revolution and rebellion, but also a kind of free swinging sentimental. She's worried about what emotions also do. She wants you to feel against slavery and think about it, but she wants to contain those emotions and hedge them around with certain kinds of warning. The other thing I think about slavery, these are poems, and she's not the only one who writes them, who are very anxious about Britain's, the corruption of Britain by its association with slavery, that Britain has to liberate itself from its slaveholding. And that's the theme. That was the theme in a lot of the poems we read, not just by Hannah Moore, but by Anne Yearsley and Letitia Barbauld, radical or conservative figures. They were very, very concerned that Britain let go of its, of its own, the stain on its own character in terms of slavery. But I just wanted to quickly go through with you just a little bit that section of the poem where she has, I think, a very bold statement that sort of echoes something that's unstated but demonstrated in Phyllis Wheatley's poetry. And here she's, demonstrated by the poem itself and by the stance of the young black woman making it. So here's Moore saying, "Perish the illiberal thought which would debase the native genius of the sable race. Perish the proud philosophy which sought to rob them of the powers of equal thought. What? Does the immortal principle within change with the casual color of a skin?" And I think that's a marvelous phrase, actually. The casual color of a skin. Notice how blackness, the Ethiop, that whole question of skin as a kind of, as the signifier of race. And the signifier of difference and objection comes in here. So she, by saying the casual color of the skin, I think that's, that has a particular meaning for a Christian poet, because it's the soul and the skin, but it also means that the skin isn't important. "Does matter govern spirit," she says next, "or is mind," and mind is in those capitals, that's not just my typo, "degraded by the form to which 'tis joined, no." And then suddenly it's, "They have heads to think and hearts to feel and souls to act with firm though erring zeal, for they have keen affections, soft desires, love strong as death, and active patriot fires. All the rude energy, the fervid flame of high-souled passion and ingenuous shame, strong but luxuriant virtues boldly shoot from the wild vigor of a savage root." And look where she's going somehow. at one minute it gives them equal thought and mind, and the next we have this sort of, it's not quite a caricature, but we're wandering down another path, another representational path. Erring zeal, keen affections, soft desires, patriot fires. You've got good things. It's good to be a patriot. It's good to love your children. The idea that slave women didn't care about their children is a kind of, pro-slavery motif. But on the other hand, rude energy, fervid flames, luxuriant virtues,
wild vigor, savage root, those are verging on the negative and the kind of scary. So the poem compromises some of its you know, hedges around some of its best moments in terms of thinking. And this is she's quite typical, Hannah Moore. I'm not trying to, you know, to pick her out especially. But you can sort of see, you know, what an anti-slavery figure who believed in absolute equality and who didn't want to figure slaves or persons of color, you know, Africans in this way, are sort of up against when they are trying to make these arguments. Anyway, I think Slavery, a Poem, is a brilliant poem, and I do suggest you go online and have a read of it. I put on, but I'm not going to talk about, just a little bit from a poem that she wrote probably with someone else and maybe without that someone else's permission, The Sorrows of Yamba, to just give you an idea of another kind of poem that a lot of Mary Robinson and others wrote. This sort of love story poem in which the poor woman slave or the poor man is dragged away from his beloved, dragged away from family first in slavery, and often dies at the end, dies or is converted, as in this case, at the end of the Yamba. But what I wanted to do there was just give you just an idea of this not quite vernacular speech that they're trying to ascribe to the person. In St. Lucy's distant isle, still with Afric's love I burned. It's very important that these figures are seen as loving their home, these sort of invented Africans. Parted many a thousand miles, never, never to return. Come, kind death, and give me rest. Yamba has no friend but thee. Thou canst ease my throbbing breast. Thou canst set the prisoner free. Born on Afric's golden coast, once I was as blessed as you. Parents tender I could boast. Husband dear, and children too. And again, it's being torn away, wanting to die, because you've lost your family, your children, you're taken away. And this is the appeal of poems like Yamba was supposed to especially appeal to women readers and so forth. And they're rather different than the kind of more politically upfront, non-sentimental versions in Slavery, a Poem, and other poems of that kind, poems directed at political figures. But they were very powerful poems, and I think we should get past the sentiments and see what kind of uses the sentiment in those poems have to try to think about them. And again, I highly recommend Mary Robinson as a poet, but also Anna Letitia Barbauld is someone you might want to read. But I want to move on. Anne Yearsley, there's the working class poet Anne Yearsley. Moore was her patron, and they had a furious fight, and she broke away from Moore. She was heavy-handing her, and her poems are much more critical, you know, sort of sharply critical of the establishment, the political establishment in Bristol where she lived. There's a milkmaid, Mary Robinson, I think. Much more typical 18th century culture. Well, she was an actress, very good one too, by all accounts. Extraordinary figure. No, okay. Elizabeth Barrett. It's a terrible portrait of Elizabeth Barrett Browning, but it's the worst. It's absolutely the worst one. And none of them, all of them, have their problems. But this is So what I wanted to do was to say that a lot of the poems that we've read, that we've been looking at, are poems that. That were written in the run-up to the abolition of the slave trade. And I wanted to have time, but I don't, but maybe in discussion I can say a few things about the body of pamphlet literature written later on in the run-up to the actual abolition of slavery, because that's actually quite important and interesting. But what I wanted to end with was to just think in apposition about Phyllis Wheatley and Elizabeth Barrett Browning a little bit, because it seems to me they make extraordinary contrasts. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, born in Coxhill, Kent, whose father was a slave owner in Jamaica, the Barretts of Jamaica, and he came with a slaveholding family, an extended slaveholding family. You can read their history. There's a whole book about them. The father lost a lot of money. They grew up in a big estate, and the family lost a lot of money, not because of the decline of slavery, but because of bad investments, really. And they moved to Wimpole Street, Elizabeth Barrett Browning in London. And from there, at an advanced age of around 40, she ran away and married the poet Robert Browning. It's a great story. But she was a fierce anti-slavery advocate. And this is a poem that she wrote after she left her father's household. He didn't allow any of his children to marry. Some of them did, but he didn't allow any. She had to run away. He's a very strange man, Edward Barrett Moulton Barrett. And she wrote the poem because, but she was already living at home when someone from the Liberty Bell, having seen her 1844 poems, very celebrated poet she was already, said, "Would you write a poem for us?" And she thought about the poem. And after she left married Browning in 1846, she wrote this poem, which was published in I think 1848. In the Liberty Bell, and then republished, of course, in her collected poems. And it's a ferocious poem. It's about a woman who is, and it's directed at the American anti-slavery movement. And I just want to end with this poem, so I'm not going to take a very long time over it, because I can see I've almost talked my allotted 50 minutes. But I want to just point out to you some of the things, because one of the things I think about this poem is that it gathers together a lot of the poetic motifs that are there, not just in women's, but in men's anti-slavery poetry of that earlier period. She's a great late romantic figure, Elizabeth Barrett Browning. She's a Victorian, but she's also a romantic. And she does it in an extraordinary way, because this is a poem about a woman, a slave woman, who murders her child. Kills her two white child. She's been raped by her master. That's a motif in a poem by Mary Robinson and other stories, many stories about the sexual depredation of slave owners on slaves. And she murders the child. And she's at Pilgrim's Point. She's in New England, and the slave catchers from the South have got her sort of penned in. So it's a transatlantic poem in the sense that you might think of it in three ways, because of course all of the Barrett's property was in Jamaica, but she's transposed the Jamaican setting to the American one in this period, and here she is, and she's already living. She and Browning moved to Italy, and she lives in Italy for the rest of her life. Spent some time in Paris, comes back to England a couple of times, but she never really returns to live in England. So if we think of this poem as a part of the what we might call the circumatlantic, that movement across the Atlantic, the black and white Atlantic, this is a way to think about this ferocious poem. Some critics think the poem is about her father, that he's the white slave owner, the figure. I think that's too simplified a reading. But anyway, look at the way it uses color. I stand on the mark beside the shore of the first white pilgrim's bended knee, where exile turned to ancestor. That is, where people who come to America as exiles suddenly became the founding fathers, and God was thanked for liberty. And again, here's a new way of using liberty. Liberty is in more. Poem is the theme. I've run through the night, my skin is as dark, I bend my knee down on this mark, I look on the sky and the sea. And those of you who know about romantic poetry, the motif of someone standing on the shore looking out to the sublime sea. You look at shipwrecks, but you look at the horizon. That's a great, that's a kind of founding moment of certain kinds of romantic poetry. You get it in other people who write anti-slavery poems, Wordsworth, Coleridge, and so forth. And So you've got this black figure, and again, like Phyllis, but now she has to be, and it's a first person. If you notice in some of these 18th century poems, the black women speak of themselves in the third person, yamba, as if, and that's part of a kind of defamiliation of the self, as if they can't say I, they have to say their names, in a sense. Yamba says this, it's part of a kind of pidgin English. But here, she doesn't use any kind of imitated slave speech of any kind. This is, she uses the same kind of English that Phyllis Wheatley would use. And she says, and again, with a kind of, the same kind of address, O pilgrim souls, I speak to you. I see you come out proud and slow from the land of the spirits pale as dew. And round me ye go. O pilgrims, I have gasped and run all night long from the whips of one who in your names works sin and woe. And, you know, if you just think back to that first poem, a poem that she very well may have read, or maybe almost certainly have read, an Ethiop speaks to you. So she, that's, again, that's the position that this white slave owner's daughter is putting herself in to speak through the poem. And so she kneels at this place, feel your souls around me hum, and lift my black face, my black hand, here in your names, to curse this land, ye blessed in freedoms evermore. And that's what's striking and shocking about. Finally, after all these poems in which women become converted or they die, occasionally they curse, but then they regret it bitterly. Most of this poem is about a curse. And another poem of Elizabeth Barrett Browning's is, again, A Curse for a Nation. She said somewhere, a curse from the depths of womanhood is very salt and bitter and good. And I named my first book that I ever published Salt and Bitter and Good, because I thought it was great, about blood, about tears, and about, you know, all kinds of things. So one of the things she's emphasizing in the poem is her blackness. I'm black, I'm black. She's not, what she isn't, is she isn't that sentimental figure that you already have. She, almost by this period of the mixed race mulatto, the tragic mulatto woman. She's emphasizing her blackness. But there's a sort of discomfort in that too. This is a black and white poem. This is a poem about color, and it's almost as if the casual color of a skin doesn't exist anymore by the 1840s, that a certain kind of idea of race and color and identity has deepened, and I think that's actually true. More than in the 18th century, I think that the idea of race as color and of difference is more profound here. And you know, she says, God made me, they say, but if he did, smiling back, he must have cast his work away under the feet of his white creatures with a look of scorn that the dusky features might be trodden again to clay. And again, look, some view our sable race with scornful eye, their color is a diabolic dye. It's almost as if she's citing the earlier poem and transforming it. And I just want to move on because I want to finish. I've got a little section which isn't the most horrific section, because there's about five or six verses of her killing the child. Instead of this being something, there's a kind of euphemistic phrase about her seduction and, you know, her rape by the, not seduction, her rape by her white master. But the death of the child is told in graphic detail. And that's a very interesting thing. The babe who lay on my bosom so was far too white to white for me, as white as the ladies who scorned to pray beside me at church but yesterday, though my tears had washed a place from my knee. Here's where she's talking about killing, strangling the child, suffocating it. I pulled the church kerchief very close. He could not see the sun, I swear, more then alive than now he does from between the roots of the mango, where, I know where, she buries him. Close, a child and a mother do wrong to look at one another when one is black and one is fair. And again, look at the absolutism of that passage. It's very disturbing, you know. The Barrett family had many mixed-race children. So, you know, this particular where the black woman says, I can't bear the child being so white. Of course, you know, child's a product of rape, and I think that's very important. And then she says, why, in that single glance I had of my child's face, I tell you all, I saw a look that made me mad, the master's look that used to fall on my soul like his lash, or worse. And so to save it from my curse, I twisted it round in my shawl. And he moaned and trembled from foot to head, he shivered from head to foot, till after a time he lay instead, too suddenly still and mute. I felt beside a stiffening cold, I dared to lift up just a fold, as in lifting a leaf of the mango fruit. And, you know, it's brutal but tender at the same time. I've not given you the most heartrending verses here, but you can go and read them for yourselves. And she, it's very extended, the death of the child, and it's because there's a prohibition, a taboo. Something terrible has happened here. And she buries the child, and she says, "Now in the dark earth, the child is dark, and so he can be mine. But when he's white, he's just the master who'll grow up to abuse me." The poem ends again with the idea of the curse, and it goes back to the political idea. For in this union you have set to two kinds of men in adverse rows, each loathing each. And again, it's a kind of voice, it's a kind of address not just to white men but to the government. Again, you're addressing, as it were, the patriarchy. you're addressing the ruling male white class. And you're using against him, Christ, the seven wounds. All forget the seven wounds in Christ's body fair when he sees gaping everywhere. But then she makes another turn, which I think is fascinating. She's a good Christian, not a denominational Christian, but a believer, Elizabeth Barrett Browning. She says, "Our countless wounds that pay no debt, our wounds are different. You white, your white men are after all not gods indeed, nor able to make Christ's again." Now that, again, is a kind of deepening of the accusations against the Bristol slave traders and the Christian hypocrites who are keeping slavery in Britain. That Christianity itself cannot, while it's holding slaves, it cannot have another Christ. Nor able to make Christ again do good with bleeding. We who bleed stand off. We help not in our loss. We are too heavy for our cross. And again, it's these millions that Moore is referring to, and fall and crush you and your seed. And she calls on other slaves to rise up and rebel in this poem. But in the last verse, of course, she can't quite have that, so she swoons. "I look at the sky. The clouds are breaking on my brain. I'm floated along as if I should die of liberty's exquisite pain. In the name of the white child waiting for me, in the death dark where we may kiss and agree, white men, I leave you all curse-free in my broken heart's disdain." I mean, it's an extraordinary poem. Even what she takes back is somehow a critique of what is. I think it's the most shocking and most complicated poem. I've been reading and teaching it for years and still haven't quite come to terms with it or thought of, But I think it's quite interesting that the poem seems to also to reflect to me a deepening of the idea of racial difference at the same time as it wants to affirm a different kind of voice for its, its invented black woman than the voice of Yamba or these other figures. And I just want to leave you with that thought. Thank you.